KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. Vice President Kamala Harris visited El Paso on Friday after weeks of criticism by Republicans over her failure to make a stop at the border. Prior to the Harris visit, Republican Governor Greg Abbott revived hardline immigration measures used by the Trump administration. Abbott has promised to continue building former President Donald Trump's border wall and says law enforcement officers will begin arresting migrants. Harris said the Biden administration's focus is on immigration reform.
Our administration, it is important to be clear, is working to build a fair and a functional and a humane immigration system. We feel very strongly about that. And as you know, we inherited a tough situation. In fact, right here in El Paso was the launch of the child separation policy. You saw it as it rolled out on the ground in real time.
As we've been telling you, prior to the vice president's visit this week, Texas Governor Greg Abbott's decision to continue construction of the border wall raised a lot of questions. Abbott raises the specter of crime when talking about the importance of the border wall, but some see a contradiction. Abbott recently signed legislation to allow Texans to carry handguns without a background check or training. In El Paso, some are also concerned the governor's portrayal of an invasion on the border will lead to violence. Fernando Garcia is executive director of the Border Network for Human Rights. He says invasion is the same word used by the gunman who attacked a Walmart in El Paso.
Let's remind ourselves that because of that narrative, somebody came to El Paso, a white supremacist from northern Texas, traveled more than 10 hours and killed 23 members of our community. So that is dangerous.
El Paso's Congresswoman Veronica Escobar also voiced her concerns on Twitter, worried that using the word invasion to promote building a Texas border wall will lead to more hate crimes. Building the wall could also take funds from other priorities. The governor says he wants to spend $250 million in state money for the wall, raising the rest with private donations. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider takes a closer look at Abbott's proposal.
Governor Abbott is justifying the need for a wall by claiming that large numbers of undocumented immigrants are coming over the border and committing crimes, for which he blames President Biden.
Make no mistake, the current administration is refusing to enforce the laws concerning immigration that are on the books passed by the United States Congress.
Political scientist Geronimo Cortina of the University of Houston says it's far from clear that Biden's policies are to blame for the increase in illegal border crossings. He says the administration is taking a different tone from President Trump, but it's sending the same message that people shouldn't come if they don't have the proper documentation. More to the point, Cortina says,
the fact that, you know, previous studies have not shown any significant or statistical correlation between immigration and crime puts to a certain extent a question mark on the governor's remarks.
Abbott announced a down payment of $250 million from state funds to begin construction of the wall. He left unsaid where the remaining billions would come from, though he suggested much of it could come from private donors.
Now, I know for a fact that many Texans and many Americans want to get involved in this process.
To that end, he unveiled a website for online donations and a mailing address to which people could send checks. Political scientist Mark Jones of Rice University's Baker Institute is skeptical.
Even if the wall was going to be built along the lines proposed by Abbott, we're talking maybe 1 or 2 miles of wall. Get up to 3 or 4 miles and you're talking $100 million, and I don't think you're going to raise that through crowdfunding.
Abbott suggested that between state land and land volunteered by private property owners, Texas already has hundreds of miles of ground available for construction. Then there's the land that the federal government seized under President Trump.
I am demanding that the Biden administration immediately return to Texans land that the federal government took to build the wall. Texas will talk to those property owners about Texas using that land to build the wall.
UH Professor Geronimo Cortina says that even if the federal government gives back the land it seized, that's no guarantee Texas will be able to use it. The result is likely to be years of court challenges.
I don't know how exactly the state of Texas is going to do that, because if the federal government says, okay, private citizen X, here's your land back, well, Texas cannot say, hey, Deeves, I want it.
Then there's the larger question of why Abbott is attempting a project that Trump attempted with all the resources of the federal government and failed. Democratic State Representative Gene Wu says it's political theater.
It's, I think, a lot of posturing and bluster from somebody who wants to run for president in 4 years.
Rice University's Mark Jones says it's also about fending off a challenge from the right in the next governor's race.
He still has aspirations of a 2024 presidential run, which requires that he both appeal to Trump voters but also do well in the 2022 primary.
Abbott himself was livid at the idea that the wall is about political posturing. He said anyone who thinks so doesn't care about the safety of people living along the border.
We believe in the rule of law and order in this state, and by God, we're going to step up and deliver that rule of law and order in the state of Texas.
Regardless, Abbott's stance guarantees the border wall will be a live issue for at least another 2 to 4 years. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
And one final note before we move on to other news this week. A report out this month from the Government Accountability Office finds the Army Corps of Engineers contract awarding process allowed for accelerated construction of former President Donald Trump's border wall. And that raises some serious questions. KJZZ's Alisa Resnick has more.
Some $10 billion in military funds were directed to the wall after Trump declared a national emergency at the border in 2019. But the report says those funds were only available for a short time. Tim DiNapoli with the GAO says the Army Corps sped up its usual contracting process to get construction going and began with public lands.
In Arizona and other places where the federal government had title to that or had access to that land, it started to build there first, as opposed to other places.
The GAO found the Corps awarded over $4 billion in non-competitive contracts and greenlit some construction projects before terms were agreed upon, resulting in avoidable expenses. But groups opposed to the wall say the project's environmental toll still needs investigation. Brian Segui is with the Center for Biological Diversity.
Regardless of how the construction was undertaken, building an impermeable border wall structure was going to have very pronounced and devastating impact.
A separate GAO report announced this month will examine how construction affected the borderlands. I'm Alisa Resnick in Tucson.
To local politics now, and an idea that has been gaining steam ever since the 2020 presidential election. The idea of a basic income for citizens. It's been tried elsewhere, and now, well, it's being discussed in Las Cruces. City Councilor Joanna Bencomo is advocating for a guaranteed basic income pilot project. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
A guaranteed basic income pilot project could be implemented in Las Cruces, giving select city residents access to monthly financial support. Councilor Joanna Bencomo is advocating for the project, proposing that American Rescue Plan Act dollars could be used to partially fund the endeavor.
Right now, we have an opportunity to be a leader in New Mexico and in the Southwest by being one of the first cities to dedicate public funds, along with private foundation dollars, towards this transformational project. A $2 million investment in a Las Cruces Guaranteed Basic Income project could support, let's say, 250 Las Cruces families for $650 a month for 12 months, or some variation of that.
According to the U.S. Census Bureau, approximately 24% of Las Cruces residents live in poverty. Councilor Bencomo says new data from the recent census could show an even dire picture, emphasizing hardships caused by the pandemic.
The income inequity gap only increased for so many people who were already vulnerable before the pandemic. The Distressed Communities Index shows a large part of the city of Las Cruces at risk or already in distress. The index also shows that in zip codes like 88001 and 88005, the situation is much more dire, with poverty rates as high as 36%.
A similar program is in the works in Santa Fe, where $500,000 in grant funding has been awarded for a pilot project estimated to reach 100 families. While council approval is still needed, the program is expected to target those under 30, attending Santa Fe Community College with children, giving them access to monthly payments for 1 year. Before anything similar could be implemented in Las Cruces, Counselor Yvonne Flores expressed a need to see more data, saying a full economic analysis would need to be done before she would consider supporting the measure.
People are starving, and that's very true. I'm not sure that this is going to be the answer. And I still see it as a band-aid because there's no cause and effect. There's no correlation between this program and people standing on their feet. I would like to see those people and their children 50 years from now to see if it's working.
Data from a universal basic income program out of Stockton, California, found that full-time employment increased during the first year of the program, rising from 28% to 40%. It's a trend Counselor Bencomo hopes to see continued in Las Cruces.
The research has found that unconditional cash helped many participants find better full-time employment because it reduced and removed so many of the material barriers to finding full-time jobs. It created capacity for goal setting and risk taking once people's basic needs were met.
Counselor Tessa Beda-Stuvi says her biggest concern is the long-term sustainability of the program. While not against the project itself, she pointed to other uses for American Rescue Plan Act dollars, like increased funding for housing assistance, saying that counselors must really think about what they want to prioritize.
If we are thinking about using the ARPA funds, there's competing priorities, and most of the things that I think we've wanted to address are all within trying to help in the same scope. And so what makes this really the make or break out of some of the other projects that we could help assist and fund?
Both Counselor Gabe Vasquez and Counselor Cassandra Gondra conveyed enthusiastic support for the pilot project. Gondra cited her experience as a social worker, saying monthly payments will lead to greater emotional and financial security for Las Cruces residents.
It's not the only answer. It's a piece of the puzzle and something that we really need to consider, especially those of us that live in the more distressed communities and zip codes. 88001 experiences quite a bit of violence specific to child abuse and neglect. And so much of what I see as a social worker is this distress, this sort of stress about where my next meal is coming, where, how am I going to pay for housing, utilities, how am I going to pay for food?
The pilot project is scheduled to be discussed in greater detail at a future work session. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Of course, New Mexico is one of the poorest states in the nation, and every year it ranks near the bottom in the Kids Count report. The well-being of New Mexico kids improved in that report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, but it does not include data for most of the pandemic, and there is a fear that children may have lost ground. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown brings us up to date.
A New Mexico child advocate group is expressing cautious optimism about incremental improvements in the latest Kids Count report. Amber Wallen with New Mexico Voices for Children says a 2021 Annie E. Casey report confirmed a 45% improvement in kids with health insurance over the previous year. She adds that the number of children living in poverty dropped by 2 percentage points.
That's 9,000 fewer kids in our state living in high poverty areas. So that's 9,000 kids and families in our state who have seen an improvement since last year when this data was reported.
Overall, New Mexico ranked 49th for child well-being in 2019, taking it out of last place from the previous year. Wallen says the higher ranking correlates with improvements the state was seeing for kids prior to the start of the pandemic. This year's ranking is based on the most recent comprehensive data and does not reflect hardships many families faced during the pandemic. Leslie Bossier with the Casey Foundation says despite improvements for many states, the data book reveals persistent racial and ethnic disparities, especially related to the pandemic.
If you look at families who were anxious about either being evicted or losing their home, the overall number was about 20%, so 1 in 5. If you look at the number of Black and Latino families, it was more like 1 in 3.
Wallen says New Mexico's data also shows significant progress in reducing teen births, as well as high school students graduating on time, a good sign for the state's future.
Our teens are going to have more opportunity as they graduate from high school, as they move into college and later into the workforce, that they'll have greater opportunities.
The Kids Count Index captures what children need most to thrive using four domains, including economic well-being, education, health and family, and community. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
To commentary now, and Otero County Commissioner Coy Griffin made headlines for his appearance at the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. That action and Griffin's controversial comments have raised alarm for some, including commentator Walt Ruppel.
Griffin was one of a handful of January 6 insurrectionists featured Sunday night on a two-hour CNN special about the riot that day at the U.S. Capitol. He was later arrested by FBI agents on federal charges of knowingly entering or remaining in any restricted building or grounds without lawful authority. Among the pearls of wisdom he dispensed were his belief that Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick and protester Ashley Babbitt are both still alive, and that Donald Trump was anointed by God. "I feel he carried God's anointing in there, because he won all the time," Griffin explained. I guess that would qualify Tom Brady for sainthood. Griffin knew what he was espousing was bat poop loony. He prefaced one statement with the qualifier, "I hate to be so crazy conspiracy-minded." Hate it or not, he then went right on being crazy. Every village has its idiot, but the fact that Griffin is an elected official smears all of us with his idiocy. A recall attempt has been started to remove Griffin from his seat on the Otero County Commission. Griffin now says he has his eyes on a new political office. He wants to be the top law enforcement officer in Catron County. And he might have a pretty good chance, assuming he's not serving time in federal prison. I'll admit, it was a little hard not to feel sorry for Griffin, watching the part of the CNN special where he's on the Capitol balcony with a bullhorn, desperately trying to get wild-eyed rioters to instead take a knee in quiet prayer and reflection. I've rarely seen anyone so ignored. A recent story by Associated Press reporter Morgan Lee presented a sad tale of Griffin's life now. Living in a trailer in Tularosa, divorced from his wife, estranged from his family, clinging to his commission seat, and bracing for federal trial. It's a hard fall from where he was last year at this time. A former pretend cowboy who earned his living twirling a lasso for European tourists at Paris Disney, Griffin formed Cowboys for Trump and rode that shtick all the way to the White House. Griffin and his band of merry cowpokes were riding high during the 2020 campaign. All of a sudden, they were experts, making regular appearances on Fox News and opining on everything from foreign policy to land rights. All, of course, delivered in a down-home, folksy style. For a few months last year, he had the attention of millions of people. Now his time is over. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Ruppel.
Walt Ruppel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. The RIDE Act would promote the development of advanced drunk and impaired driving prevention technology and require auto manufacturers to implement that technology in new car models. The act is co-sponsored by New Mexico U.S. Senator Ben Ray Lujan.
The RIDE Act, that's an acronym for Reduce Impaired Driving for Everyone Act. It has the potential to end drunk driving in the United States and has been estimated to save as many as 10,000 lives per year. According to a report from Safewise, New Mexico ranks fifth in the nation for drunk driving deaths right now. So you can see why this technology matters to families all across New Mexico, as well as all across the entire country. And about 29 years ago, Fred, I myself sadly was hit head-on by a drunk driver coming home from a City League basketball tournament that I was playing in, and I was less than half a mile from my house. And as I came around this turn right in front of the local church where, it's not far from home, a car came right into me. All I saw was two headlights that met me that night. And I'm here to tell that story still. There's so many folks that have had loved ones taken from them And so to all the victims out there, to all the survivors out there, everyone that lost loved ones, we're in this together. And there's no reason that these auto manufacturers cannot be implementing these technological advancements to stop drunk drivers and impaired drivers from killing others. And this would be technology that would be built right into a car. Think about how automobile manufacturers have been required to include and build now seatbelts, even backup cameras. You may remember it wasn't too long ago. We were losing hundreds of kids a year that were getting killed that a backup camera is now preventing those deaths as well. And so this is going along those same lines. This would be technology embedded in vehicles. And there's some vehicles that already have some elements of this technology in them that are on the roads today. Think about that driver assist or the warnings if you're going into the middle lane or onto the shoulder or you come up on a vehicle too fast. There's vehicles now that will slow you down if not stop you, and that will shake the car a little bit and will rattle you if you're going in and out of your lane too much.
You know, I think anyone hearing this would say this is a great idea. It's a tool that people ought to have in a new vehicle. But as you know, it's very hard in Congress to pass a new mandate like this. What do you think it will take to convince those who normally don't vote for mandates to do so in this case?
So, Fred, you've identified one of the impediments and the barriers that have existed for so many years with requiring this technology to be mandated in automobiles. We had a vote this last week in the Commerce Committee in the United States Senate where the ride legislation that we just talked about passed without a member voting against its inclusion in the big bill, and it passed overwhelmingly with Democratic and Republican votes. It now sets it up to go to the Senate floor, and we have overwhelming support, including members of the United States Senate that had not historically co-sponsored this bill. We also have members from the Michigan delegation, not just in the U.S. Senate, but in the U.S. House, leading efforts. Now, that says a lot because that's the home to a lot of these auto manufacturers in America. So when you have these incredible stories that have been shared with us from families who had loved ones taken from them, survivors of drunk driving crashes, you have the leadership of Mothers Against Drunk Driving and all of the boards and advocates, not just from New Mexico, but across America, where we are all working together. That's how you build momentum to pass a piece of legislation like this. And I am absolutely confident that this bill will be signed into law this Congress by President Joe Biden.
New Mexico U.S. Senator Ben Ray Lujan. In a recent study, by the way, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety found that more than 9,400 drunk driving deaths could be prevented each year if drunk driving prevention technology is made standard on every new vehicle. Well, speaking of technology, we move now to the 75th anniversary of the Physical Science Laboratory at New Mexico State University, looking at technologies to improve our national security. In a moment, we'll talk with a PSL retiree, Bernie McCune, but first, PSL Director Eric Sanchez.
I'll start out saying that we're very adaptive and very agile. If you look at COVID-19, we had to react like everybody else did, but you know, we never fully shut down, but we did, you know, reduce the amount of people that were inside Anderson Hall, but still were able to make the mission happen. So I would say that to begin with. Strategically, you know, our goals and vision are in line with LEADS 2025. So we work closely with the university to make sure that we're on par with where they're trying to go, and we're helping them get there from our perspective. And then finally, just that we have three divisions. You mentioned the missions that we have, but we have the Information Sciences and Security Systems Division. We have Telemetry Missile Systems Division and Aerospace Division. So three division directors, as well as a production capability.
And give us a sense, Eric, of how important this work is to national security.
I would say very important. Our Information Sciences and Security Systems Division works closely with the Army and other services on their vulnerability and survivability assessment of new weapon systems. So, you know, if they can't survive in a test, they're definitely not going to survive when they get out to the warfighter. So that's very important. Our support to missile testing, the Missile Defense Agency, as well as the newly stood up Space Force. We do a lot of work with them. So strategically, very important. And then our unmanned aerial system support that we provide to the FAA, as well as Department of Defense, is very important to national defense and homeland security.
You mentioned Space Force, which is, of course, a new effort by the federal government. Does this mean that we might be seeing PSL involved with work at some point at Spaceport America?
Potentially with Spaceport America, we actually do some of our UAS testing, our unmanned aerial systems, based on the elevation and altitudes that they can go to. We often have to work closely with them, so that's already ongoing. As far as the Space Force goes, so there is a small contingent already at White Sands Missile Range, if you weren't aware of that. And we've done some testing out at Wallops Island in Virginia that supported some things that the Space Force is interested in.
And of course, for folks who aren't familiar with UAS or unmanned aerial systems, they're drones, right?
Correct.
Okay, and that's something that folks are very familiar with on the consumer market, maybe less so, but certainly an issue that's more well known, that the military uses drones extensively. And we've heard about drones being tested at Holloman Air Force Base for the work that they do for the military. Speaking of important work, Eric, tell me about the current opportunities for students at PSL.
Well, first I want to start out by talking from 1946 until present. We did a little check on this, and we've had up to 20,000 students that have come through.
Wow.
Over that time period. And currently we have about 25 students that are working in the facility, and that ranges from our security team, our information technology team, our shipping and receiving, our IT, as well as our facility support. And then all three of our division directors have at least one, and many more in some divisions, students that are supporting their efforts as well.
20,000, that's a lot of students.
It is.
That's pretty exciting. Bernie, you talked about this in one of your answers earlier, that there were always students involved when you worked at PSL for many, many years. Give me a sense of student involvement when you were at PSL, the kinds of experiences students could have working there.
Well, it was even before my time in 46. This whole place started with basically students. I mean, there were very few staff at that time doing data reduction on V2s. So, I mean, students started the lab, and we had probably 30 or 40 students before we had any staff. But in my case, and those were really data, they were running calculators, they were, you know, doing plots for the V2. In my time was these kids, I mean, they were really mature off the farm, some of them who were really capable with their hands, that were running tracking stations, satellite tracking stations, running generators, communication systems. And so I, in Argentina, I was the only staff member, and I had 11 students down there. We were running the communications van, the tracking van, the diesel generator sets, because the power was different down there. We had to have our own diesels. And so if I didn't have good students, I would have not been able to carry out that mission for sure. So, yeah, I mean, students have been with us for a long time. And I think our hope is that we get some more in here, because they're really great.
And I'm guessing, Bernie, that this really is incredible for their education, that they learn a lot at PSL, but career-wise, it also might help them down the line in deciding what they want to do.
Well, I mean, it helps them career-wise if they get out in the field. They're electrical engineers, and they're working with scopes. They're working with equipment. They can come back to their labs and guide the lab. So the whole thing with students that in their career choice is that I think, as soon as they graduate from here and they have this co-op experience, they're grabbed right up. I mean, it's just incredible that their opportunities go way up, I think.
So it's not just a matter of them getting a better focus on what they want to do. This also makes them more marketable.
It does. I mean, it's really, a few of my students with me in satellite tracking found out they wanted to be riders and not, I mean, they were traveling. And so they weren't really as much interested in the technical side, but most of them, it focused them really well.
You can watch my entire interview with PSL retiree Bernie McCune and PSL director Eric Sanchez tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV. You'll also find it on the Newsmakers page in the local TV section at krwg.org. KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. Great to be with you. Doñana County now has a clearer picture concerning how American Rescue Plan Act dollars will be allocated following approval of a spending plan this week by county commissioners. Here's Madison Staten.
The Doña Ana County Commission has approved a spending plan for American Rescue Plan Act funds totaling over $42 million. Spending priorities include premium pay for essential county workers, flood mitigation, partial funding for a new Office of Emergency Management building, and other measures to support public health and critical infrastructure needs. Inside Consultancy CEO Rosalinda Natividad, who presented to the commission, noted changes to the original proposal, which include dedicating an extra $1 million to a broadband feasibility study.
We have increased the amount for broadband feasibility studies and implementation of findings by $1 million. This was an effort to ensure that projects that have been identified by IT have a stronger budget and more robust effort to leverage federally identified funds or other state funds.
Another change is the number of county employees who will receive premium pay under the American Rescue Plan Act. While the original plan allocated $4,000 payments to all county workers as essential employees, the new plan is more limited, impacting approximately 655 staff members, according to County Manager Fernando Macias.
The county manager, under the description, would have the authority to apply these funds to all of our employees. We're just not seeing that is the trend in terms of the interpretation across the country. And so in order to make sure that there aren't any issues in terms of the audit of these funds and the final appropriate utilization of these funds, the more conservative view is to approach it in terms of the more traditional interpretations under the HEROES Act, which again is very broad-based and is going to allow us to address more than 600 of our current employees.
He says Doña Ana County is currently preparing a plan to cover premium payments for all remaining employees with additional county funds. Macias also noted that $10 million in American Rescue Plan Act funding has been reserved for future commitments. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
The StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative visited Las Cruces in March of last year, and every week we're presenting portions of those interviews. Today, a second portion of the conversation with retired Army Colonel and Vietnam vet Larry Candelaria and his wife, Connie.
Because of all the achievements during my time there, I was there an extra month, and I finally left in May, at the end of May. United States Army Vietnam decided to recognize my achievements, and they gave me an Impact Award, the Bronze Star. I came back to the United States. I was shaking. I couldn't sleep. My ex-wife said, "You better go to a psychiatrist. I can't stand the way you're behaving." So I did. I went to the psychiatrist, and he said, "It's normal. Not to worry." And I thought, yeah, right. It's easy for you to say that. What about me? Well, I continued to have nightmares of dead bodies, smell of rotting blood and flesh, burned flesh, faces of individuals, and for that I got lorazepam, 1 milligram. And anyway, that seemed to put me at ease. I attended the advanced course. I was assigned to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri in 1972 through 75. I was assigned as chief of station of choice, and I was the adjutant of the reception station initially. I was there almost three years, and then I became the chief of station of choice. Station of choice was a program where soldiers could volunteer out of high school, and they would keep them all together, all through basic and advanced individual training. So it was a very good program, and we went through all the schools. We had a special group of soldiers, real sharp, women and men, and we brought teachers, principals, superintendents, and let them see what these soldiers would go through. Leonard Wood had, of course, all the engineering. It's an engineer post, so they had electrical. They had detonation specialists. They had heavy equipment operators. And I retired at Fort Myer, Virginia, on June the 30th, 1989. The rest of it, you know, I was, I found a job with the CSI, which was a startup firm.
Competitive Services Incorporated, I believe.
Competitive Solutions Incorporated.
Solutions, yes, excuse me.
And then I went to another law firm, Coons McKinney, Johnson & Regan, from 1990 to 1995. I was a director of administration and systems. I was there 5 years, and then I decided that that was long enough. And I got a call from my advisor that said, hey, if you quit now, you have enough money that you're making more money not working than working. So then I had established Executive Solutions Consulting Group in 87 to 2003. I advised veterans from the private sector companies on improving efficiencies and how to get jobs, how to dress for success, how to interview, etc. I did that. I established the American Legion post called John Feslola Belleville Post, 1775 at Fort Belleville, Virginia. And I was the first commander. I was a commander twice. Then I got sick, and the doctor said, you got asthma, you got to get out of here, go back to where you came from. So I came back to El Paso. I felt that El Paso was too much like Washington, made me nervous. And after 25 years of being in Washington, D.C., I decided to go to a little town, which I told my wife is a little cow town named Las Cruces, New Mexico. And it turned out to be not the cow town I thought, but rather a very vibrant area. And I became the Director of Veterans Affairs at Doña Ana County at the Sheriff's Department, and then also at the same time at the Veterans Center for 5 years. Subsequently, I became the Director of Veterans Affairs at White Sands Missile Range for 12 years, handling over 10,000 veterans and their families. And to date, I continue to help veterans. Vietnam was not a negative experience for me, but it did leave wounds in me, in my brain.
As with many other men and women.
Many other men. Many, many marriages were broken because of Vietnam. Men could not get over the PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and many of them are still suffering. That's why I dedicated 12 years of my life and 5 years with the Sheriff's Department and the Vet Center and 12 years at White Sands Missile Range to veterans and their families, because I know the pain that it is.
To hear this segment, as well as the full interview with retired Army Colonel and Vietnam vet Larry Candelaria and his wife Connie, go to the StoryCorps page under radio at krwg.org. Funding for this segment provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents, accepting admission in their 3 sanitized homes. More at 575-525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. The changing of the seasons, fundamental dates for indigenous South American cultures that are bound to their relationship with the natural world. In Bolivia, David Feagan explores the incredible history behind a resilient people and why many continue to journey to ancient ruins to receive the first rays of the sun at the winter solstice.
As the sun goes down in Tiwanaku, Bolivia, the sound of sikuri players strikes up. It's the evening of the 20th of June, and with the first rays of sun tomorrow, the Aymara people who live in this region will celebrate Machak Mara, which means the return of the sun. Likewise, in other parts of the country and across the South American continent, Quechua people will celebrate Inti Raymi, which means the party of the sun. To Westerners, it's known as the winter solstice. Yet there is a lot of cultural history that separates Machak Mara and Inti Raymi from simple definitions of this celebration. Tiwanaku is a country town located outside the bustling city of La Paz in the Bolivian Altiplano, or High Plateau, at almost 13,000 feet above sea level. It's found in the south of the Lake Titicaca Basin, the highest big lake in the world that stretches between Peru and Bolivia in a region packed with spiritual significance. Tiwanaku is home to an ancient archaeological site, the ruins of the political and spiritual center of a mysterious culture. For those who can read them, the archaeological structures not only show a precise knowledge of astronomy and astrology, but contain ancient wisdom that speaks of a shared worldview among other ancient regional cultures. To understand Tiwanaku's place in history and its influence today, I speak to anthropologist Dr. José Illescas. He explains that to do this, it's important to understand the mixing of cultures in the South American region over time, before it was divided into the separate countries we know today. At its peak, it was known as Tahuantinsuyu. That was the name of the Incan Empire, but can also be read as a grand confederation of indigenous nations and the collection of all the cultures that had come before.
Estas culturas todas en su conjunto, sean de Perú, de Bolivia, de Ecuador, de Colombia, de Venezuela, todas.
Dr. Illescas says that these cultures as a whole, be they from Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, Colombia, Venezuela, were all cultures that had a feeling of living in unity with the totality of nature to develop societies and cultures of unity and abundance as a model of civilization. A model that can return at this time of global crisis in our current civilization, he says.
Es el impacto de Tiwanaku en su momento.
This is the impact of Tiwanaku in its moment, says Dr. Illescas, that extends to the present because cultures don't die. In any case, they leave their influence or their mark on the present, not only in what they have done materially, but also in their genes. Dr. Illescas says that the Tiwanaku culture started about 1500 years before Christ and lost its influence almost 1800 years AD. Its original name was Taipikala, which translates to the central fundamental stone.
La importancia se debía a la hegemonía y a la dominación que había alcanzado. El centro,
the importance of Tiwanaku was due to the distance and domination that the Tiwanaku center and leadership reached over spaces in the Altiplano, says Dr. Illescas. Not only in the Altiplano, but they also reached the western side, which is the north of Chile and the south of Peru today. In addition, their influence reached Cochabamba and the Chapare in the central valleys and rainforests of Bolivia.
Entonces, como influía, era como que yo vaya a la Meca en Nueva York queriendo vivir el sueño norteamericano.
To give you an example of their influence, he says, it would be like if I went to the Mecca of New York wanting to live the North American dream. So, the temptation was forced, preached, or created that it was necessary to go to the center of the city of Tiwanaku to receive the winter solstice. Taipikala, or Tiwanaku as it is known today, is an important waka. Iriapa Calisaya is a political scientist and professor at the Public University of El Alto, Bolivia. Kadisaya is from the Umasuyu Nation that recognizes Tiwanaku as the sacred ancestral city. He explains that waka refers to any sacred entity. They are diverse and distinct, and can be a mountain or a rock, a river or a well, for example. Even your own home can be a waka, or they can be things you can move and take with you.
Tiwanaku es una waka porque está ubicado en un lugar sagrado.
Firstly, Tiwanaku is a waka because it is located in a sacred place, says Kadisaya. But at the same time, it's a place that receives a lot of energy from the stars.
Entonces, al recibir ese espacio mucha energía y al construirse ahí las
So, because this place receives a lot of energy and there are constructions there, that's why it's being constituted as a central waka. Not only for the indigenous people of this place, but also for the indigenous people who today live in Peru, as well as parts of Ecuador. In other words, he says, Tiwanaku is an important place, but there are other important wakas as well. Kadisaya says these were sites the Spanish tried to destroy by replacing them with their own religious icons as they sought to evangelize the Americas after arriving at the end of the 15th century.
Hubo muchas maneras de poder extirpar esa idolatría, como decían ellos. Entonces, una manera era
There were many ways to root out this so-called idolatry, says Kadisaya. One way was to build churches on top of them. The San Francisco Church in La Paz, the Laja Church, the church in Copacabana. All these churches are built on top of huacas. On top of the hills, they put crosses.
O si no, había algunos padres que fabricaban de arcilla, de...
He says there were even some priests who made virgins or saints from clay or stucco. By taking advantage of the cover of night, they would leave these virgins and saints in very important huacas. And when people attended this huaca, they would subsequently find a virgin. Then they would say, look, a virgin has appeared here in this waka. So they would change the name of that place for the name of a virgin or a saint, says Kadisaya. These were the strategies that the West used to eradicate the beliefs, the wakas, and the religions of the indigenous nations. Both Dr. Iliescas and Kadisaya explain that the Spanish also tried to cover indigenous religious dates and spiritual celebrations with their own. For example, the Spanish attempted to erase Machacmara and Inti Raymi with the Christian celebration of San Juan. Then, after the Spanish were kicked out, came the religious oppression of the Bolivian Republic. Due to this mixing of cultures, Dr. Iliesca says this probably explains why today the winter solstice seems to capture the collective attention of Bolivian nationals and tourists in such a big way. This is despite the summer solstice and two equinoxes being similarly important dates in cultures that have historically orientated themselves by the seasons. Yet, evangelist attempts to erase these cultures failed. Kadisaya says this was because indigenous groups knew how to maintain their own culture. Sometimes, this included doing so within the same Western religions that oppressed them. Finally, in more recent times, indigenous cultures like the Aymaras and Quechuas have slowly been able to take back and make visible their beliefs and traditions without fear of persecution in Bolivia.
Por eso el 21 de junio se recuerda el Inti Raymi o el Machacmara.
That's why it's true that on June 21st, Inti Raymi, or Machacmara, is remembered as a cultural act, as an act of celebration, as a ritual act, but deep down, it's a subversive act against Western culture, says Kadisaya. Back to the present June 20th, and the sun is dying in Tiwanaku, making way for a long, cold night. But this death is not final, as in the Western perception. It will be reborn again in the morning. It's now 6 a.m. on the 21st of June. Wise men called Amautas and community members enter the ruins of Tiwanaku along with authorities and the press. The fact that this date is a nationally recognized holiday is not something that has come easily, and some try to clamber in after the entourage of the Bolivian president, Luis Arce. However, they are denied access due to COVID-19 restrictions. This year, they have to receive the sun's first rays outside with others who have made the journey. Inside the ruins, offerings are placed on top of a large bonfire, which is then lit, while speeches are made in Aymara and Spanish. Among them is Don Lucas Choque, the founder of the Council of Amautas of Tiwanaku.
Tenemos varios elementos en dulces.
There are several elements in the offerings, in sweets and their meanings. We also have the Lama, he says, which is the transporter of the message carried to our celestial father, our father sun. As the sun is reborn over Tiwanaku, people raise their hands to receive its energy in every part of their body, which is particularly important as Bolivia tidily navigates its third wave of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Se sigue yendo a este lugar porque la Aymara actual siente en su corazón todavía.
Dr. Ilescas says the current Aymara continues to go to this place because in their heart they still feel that they belong to some root, to their historical root. And whatever happens, they go back to their roots. And if they come back on the winter solstice, let it be right on time. It is simply a return to their roots.
No se puede satanizar esto.
And you can't demonize that, he says. After the ceremony, the morning sun illuminates the ruins beautifully. The Bolivian Altiplano is one of those places that changes its mood several times in a day, based on the position of the sun and the weather. This morning, the light from the sun is crisp and softer than it will be later in the day when it beats down on this elevated part of the world. It feels good after the long cold night. People are laughing from behind their face masks and there is a lightness about the mood.
La espiritualidad no discrimina a nadie.
Spirituality doesn't discriminate against anyone. Rather, it hugs everyone, says Don Lucas. We are not idealists who make others believe our ideas, but rather, we say Pacha, a term in Aymara and Quechua that means cosmos, universe, time, space, and earth. That's what we transmit. Finally, Don Lucas has a message for some friends in the United States.
También quiero saludar a todos los hermanos, a los Hopis, Navajos, y otros hermanos en los Estados
I also want to greet all our brothers, the Hopis, Navajos, and other brothers in the United States, because in 2010, I shared a great meeting of Condor and Eagle with him in the Grand Canyon, he says.
Y desde aquí saludo pues a mi hermano Adam Hillover, el pájaro amarillo. También ha estado aquí en Tiwanaku, el hermano pájaro.
From here in Tiwanaku, greetings to my brother Adam Hallover, the Yellow Bird. Brother Yellow Bird has also been here in Tiwanaku, which is why I want to greet him. He too is carrying spirituality and culture. All over the planet Earth we have our culture. We have our indigenous wise men brothers. For KRWG Public Media, I'm David Fegan in Tiwanaku, Bolivia.
Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. I'm Fred Martino. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.